Welcome to Franchise Fan Guys. This is our 9th episode on X-Men. More specifically, X-Men Dark Phoenix. I'm Tom Breifogel, joined with Andy Schmidt and Skid Marr. Why don't you guys say what's up?
Hey, what's up? I'm Andy Schmidt, and like Charles Xavier, or Xavier, if you speak English, I'm always sorry. I always have a speech, and nobody cares.
That's right, and I'm Skid Marr, and speaking on behalf of my colleagues, we will endeavor to make this a better podcast than this was a movie.
Wow, you use endeavor like the space shuttle in the movie. That is great.
That's part of the movie.
That is very clever. Well done. I think you've succeeded in making this a better podcast than that was a movie already.
Okay. All right, turn off the lights. We got it.
Nailed it.
Franchise Fan Guys. X-Men Dark Phoenix came out in June of 2019, also rated PG-13, directed by Simon Kinberg, also the screenplay by Simon Kinberg, starring Michael Fassbender, Jennifer Lawrence, James McAvoy, Nicholas Hoult, Jessica Chastain, and Sophie Turner. Had a budget of $200 million, domestic gross of $66
million, ouch.
International gross of $187 million,
still
for a total
kind of
gross
ouch.
Of $253 million. Rotten Tomatoes critic score of 22, with an audience score surprisingly high of 64.
Hey, can we we should do our recap, but can we do our scores first? Or I mean, we can do
first.
The recap. Yeah, instead of doing them at the end after the discussion, because I felt like with Apocalypse, like I could feel myself hating that movie more and more as we discussed it. And so I think maybe like give it the rating clean before we like potentially convince each other of things. But I can do a recap first and then we can do a rating. I don't know. Is that not okay?
Let's do the rating and then the recap. So you guys go first. Andy, what's your number? 1 through 10.
I'm giving this one a 6.
Okay. I'm going to give this a 5.
I'm going to give it a 3.
Wow. Okay.
I would like to note that that's still above Apocalypse. That was still above what he gave Apocalypse.
It is.
That's true. Yeah.
But Apocalypse, I mentioned in the last episode, I've mentioned many times on the show, if I get really bored in a movie, I either have to exercise or drink alcohol. And while watching Apocalypse, I did drink a lot of alcohol. And then I watched this right afterwards. So I think I was already in a bad mood. I saw this in the theater. I remember not liking it in the theater, but I remember this last time just like rolling my eyes and like daydreaming and being like, what is this? Why does this exist? So I'm sorry. So I'm probably not the best reviewer of Dark Phoenix.
What I'm hearing is that during
the perfect reviewer.
Yeah, what I'm hearing is that during watching Apocalypse, you drank and exercised. And that during Dark Phoenix, you just drank. And therefore, it's a better film. But I also saw this in the theater. And then watching it for the podcast was only the second time I had seen it. But I didn't see this like opening weekend or anything. So like the critic reviews and like the vitriol that the world spat at this movie. And I'm not even saying that it's not founded. But like... There was such hatred for this movie, and like the critic score was 22%. That's lower than Batman v Superman. I think
I like Batman v Superman more.
Okay, let's just not go into that right now. But that is a conversation for another podcast. That when I went to see it in the movie, like my expectations were so low that like, I mean, if there was anything in it at all that I liked, I was probably going to enjoy it because my expectations were just dashed. So it was interesting seeing it this time, knowing what the movie was, but like not having that like super lowered expectation. And this time I went in more like eyes open, I guess, or whatever, but I still didn't hate it. The way that a lot of other people do. And it's funny, I'm on like a couple of like Discord and Facebook groups of like other comic book people and stuff. And I put on one of those like, hey, turns out I don't hate this movie. And I don't quite understand why it's so hated. And there was a guy on the Discord group that like really wanted to argue why he thought that people hate this movie so much. And his argument was that, was that Simon Kinberg had written X-Men 3 and like knew that he missed the mark on the Dark Phoenix storyline. And so this was like his thing doing it again. And he made the same mistakes. And so he thought people hated it because like they remade the movie and they made the same mistakes again. And I was just like, I don't buy that because like your average moviegoer has no idea that Simon Kinberg had anything to do with either of these movies. So like that would not be a factor. But
I didn't until right now, until reading this.
Yeah, but I mean, it was mildly interesting as a take on it. But yeah, I don't hate this movie. It's definitely problematic, but I don't hate it. I hate parts of it, little bits of it, but I don't hate it overall. And I feel weird saying
okay,
that.
So what's the movie about?
Skid, did you give your rating?
Yeah, I gave it 5.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's right. So, and you gave it a 3, right, Tom?
Yeah.
So I'll do the recap on this one because we talked about X-Men 3, which incorporates much of the Dark Phoenix storyline from the comics. This version of the Dark Phoenix storyline is closer to the comics. It's still not super close, but the idea here is that the X-Men have an adventure that sets them off into space to rescue the space shuttle Endeavor. And while out in space, they encounter this cosmic force, this cosmic entity, and it essentially goes into Jean Grey, the telepath and telekinetic character, and it gives her like this big power. And one of the questions, and it's a little ambiguous in here, which is fine, is does the force inside of her, this cosmic force, does that start to make her more angry and more rage, or does that come from like, was she always this way? And so there's this sort of like subplot that like she accidentally, with her powers when she was little, caused a car accident that like killed her mom, and that's what led her into Xavier's care. And so Xavier was trying to help her, and he like put like mental blocks in her that she didn't know about to like, so she wouldn't have to deal with that trauma, basically. And so then all those mental blocks start to break down, and she's ultra powerful. And in a scuffle, she, with the X-Men, she kills Mystique, Raven, and then that creates like a rift. And so like about a couple of the X-Men, well, really just Beast, I guess, is okay with killing her. And the other X-Men are trying to save her, and then Magneto gets involved, and bad things happen.
All right.
All right.
Thanks for that recap. So question one. There's really no way to discuss this from a franchise point of view without comparing it to X-Men 3, The Last Stand. So let's dive in. With all the things that didn't work in X-3, were any of them corrected here? Skid?
I think that there is a basic problem that keeps getting run into when trying to adapt the Dark Phoenix storyline, and that is that it really they just keep trying to do it in a movie, and one movie. And Chris Claremont, I was looking at this, he gave an interview with Games Radar like 4 years ago, and he was talking about why, like, this is the one thing that he really wants to see on screen and hasn't worked yet. And he argues that it really has to be done either like Harry Potter, the films, or like an HBO series, where he argues that you really do have to get to know these characters in a particular way, given that chance to do, for the story to have the kind of impact that it needs to have. And I think that the story as it is basically kind of unadaptable in this format. So, it's another swing. It's another miss. I think I prefer it a little bit to what happened in 3. There are some things that I think they course corrected on a little bit, but for the most part it is, yeah, I mean, it's another failure. And I don't know if we'll ever get the kind of adaptation that Claremont kind of asks for, but here's hoping.
Tom, what do you think?
I just think I thought it was really clunky and like kind of confusing, and I really don't like X-Men 3 at all either. So I don't know. I hate to be so negative, but
it's okay.
Yeah,
I like negative, Tom.
There were a lot of really cool things visually, but that's, yeah, about it, which that almost seems more insulting when it's such a bad movie, but like, it's obviously a lot of money was spent and it looks really good. That's like a terrible song with an orchestra behind it. Like, I hate that. So,
that's such a good analogy too. Yeah.
What'd you think, Andy?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of agree. I mean, I was kind of saying I didn't really agree with the one creator I was talking about earlier on the chat group, but what I do agree with him, I just didn't agree with him about the like the whole Simon Kinberg, and people would know that Simon Kinberg was involved. But I do agree with him that they do make a lot of the same mistakes. Like, if this is your attempt at correcting, you make some of the same mistakes, and there are two major ones, and one is, I don't know why in both of those films they felt like it was a good idea to make Xavier essentially the bad guy. In both versions, Xavier is at fault and is to some degree to blame for Dark Phoenix existing, to some degree. In this one, it's more overt even than in X-Men 3, but it's the same basic idea, which is that he put these blocks up and he like was like in the implication being that like he screwed with this kid's mind when she was little, and now that is coming, that I guess misdeed or whatever is coming home to roost, right? And so this is what you get when you bottle that all up. And I don't like that for a couple of reasons. One is, it doesn't really feel like Xavier. Like, in every other interaction we see with him, he's like really nurturing and is like really trying to rehabilitate people and doesn't take shortcuts. And like, even in X-Men 2, like he's like, he tells Wolverine, like, there are just some things you need to discover for yourself. Like, even if I can get to those parts of your brain, that's not the way to do it. Like, you have to do it. But here he's just like, yeah, well, I'll just do it. I'll like change this kid's personality. That'll be fine. It just doesn't hold true to, and this isn't like a continuity thing. We've talked about they play fast and loose with continuity, but it's a consistency thing. And I think that's a really important distinction. You need to be consistent with your characters. You can play a little fast and loose with your continuity. As long as your characters resemble the same people, then you're probably okay. And that just doesn't ring true. It also seems like a very easy out for the character doing bad things. And then the other aspect is, and I can't believe I'm saying this, having worked with Chris a number of times, I do kind of agree with Chris Claremont that that this is not the best format. I feel like X-Men 2 needed an X-Men 3 that, where this was a subplot that was growing.
Yeah.
X-Men 4 could have been really the Dark Phoenix thing. But
you can't spring it in one movie. You can't spring it on people that way. It just doesn't work.
I'm sure it's doable, but I mean, but they didn't do it twice.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's not the ideal way to do it. You probably could do it, but
right.
Yeah, there's better ways to go about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely other things with this film that I think don't work great, but those are the two things. When comparing it to X3, I'm like, yeah, I mean, those are the same kind of two big things that don't work. And then in addition to that, in both movies, there are a lot of other things, lesser but still sometimes large, that also don't work. But those are the two kind of kind of big ones for me. And just the I think part of the Chris Claremont thing that he's right about is like the turn just happens too quickly and it doesn't feel, I think earned isn't the right word, but it doesn't feel like it holds water. And you're like, why is she so angry and so evil right now? Right.
Yeah.
Or it just turns too quickly and it doesn't quite feel justified. So yeah, I think they do make the two same cardinal sins, whatever.
No, I mean, it is something that ideally you just really want to have that build. Like you want to be able to build to it. And it's in like a sort of semi-serialized storytelling format like this. It's like, it just feels off just packing all of that development into one of these installments.
Can I just say that I do think there's one thing X3 gets right about the storyline that this one doesn't? Mm-hmm. Which is, sure. It, to some degree, the ending. I mean, we can quibble about the climax of both of these, but at least in X-Men 3, Jean Grey has a recognition that she is too dangerous to live and that it's her. So I don't remember if she asks Wolverine to kill her. I think she does. And She does, right?
I think so.
But she essentially like depowers herself long enough to be killed because she knows she's too dangerous to live.
Yeah.
I think that worked. And this one, that doesn't happen at all. Like there's really no reason, like watching this movie, why she has to die. Like this movie, it feels like it is the Phoenix Force that is the evil doer, and it's a separate entity from her. And then she gives it to the alien chick, and it kills the alien woman. And I'm not sure why they fly into space and blow up. Like she seems like she'd be fine.
Yeah,
like I got rid of it, and the bad guy's dead, and the Phoenix Force is gone. Cool. I can go back. Probably I'll go to prison, but I can still live my life, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
But her decision to die in this one feels like a cop out. Whereas her decision to die in X3 feels like an inevitability.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. So besides those things, are there any other reasons you think this failed to connect twice with the audience?
Well, it's not very—it's not very good.
Yeah, I think that's a big reason.
Skid, I feel like you're going to give a more nuanced answer. So go, you go.
Well, I was going to say something that I do. Well, there are a couple things I do like. There are three things that I can think of off the top of my head that I do like in this movie. One is the opening, which I mistakenly mentioned in the last episode. The shuttle rescue is a cool sequence. And in that, when that's sort of being discussed, there's sort of a glimpse of Xavier's philosophy as opposed to Eric's philosophy, Magneto's philosophy, which is Magneto places the needs of mutants above the needs of humans. And Xavier really kind of puts the needs of humans above the need of mutants, which is really interesting. It's like, it's kind of, I think the way he sees it, it's kind of the only way that this will work. Like, sacrifice is required for mutants in order to, and it's not, it's unjust, but it's what they have to do to kind of, you know, finally win over Homo sapiens.
And you know what? We do see that play out in real life, right? Like the fact that African-American kids are taught, like, when you're pulled over, you have to put your hands on the steering wheel and you have to do all of these things, right? Like they shouldn't. They absolutely shouldn't have to do those
things. It's not
differently
fair.
From white kids. But they do. A reality. I would agree with that. I think that's really I think that's insightful.
It's really interesting to think about. So that's something pretty cool. I really liked the train fight at the end. Part of me just, I love seeing Magneto unleashed and seeing him, his last like sort of confrontation with the alien with the guns and stuff. That was neat. That was cool. I like that.
I mean, anytime you put Michael Fassbender on screen as Magneto, there's like a base minimum level of entertainment.
Exactly.
Of the new cast, Fassbender and Nicholas Holt, to me, are the two big winners.
Totally agree.
Until this movie, I would have put Jennifer Lawrence in that, but I think she's kind of sleepwalking through this one.
Yeah, she's not. She clearly didn't really want to be, she clearly didn't want to be in makeup. Like, she's only has three scenes where she's in the makeup, so it's just it doesn't seem like she wanted to be there as much. But Nicholas Holt has a great scene too, where he's sort of arguing with Xavier over the breakfast table at night. They're just why won't you admit that you were wrong? You know, that's some great acting, a great performance from Nicholas Holt in that moment.
I agree with you about the performance, and McAvoy's there too. I don't think that scene is written really well, and partially because of what I was saying earlier about Xavier being the bad guy. You're right that Xavier is the one that's sort of seeing things through the humans' perspective, or is putting the needs of the humans above the mutants, I guess. I think that's what you said. But
yeah,
the other thing that this movie does is basically say that it's Xavier's ego that's a problem. And again, that doesn't track
feel
for me.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't feel right. A really, really well acted scene, right? I agree with you. That is probably the best acted scene, especially by Holt, in the movie. Mm-hmm. It doesn't quite work because it just doesn't feel true to the character.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And the other thing that I like, and this is, we talk about bringing your own sort of your own experiences into the movie. Have you guys seen the movie Under the Skin? Have you seen that movie?
I don't think so.
It's 2000. Who's in that? It was Scarlett Johansson.
No.
Oh my God. Well, I highly recommend both to you two guys and everyone listening at home or wherever you listen. Please watch Under the Skin. I slept on it for a long time. I didn't realize that it was directed by Jonathan Glazer, who also directed Sexy Beast and is just one of my absolute favorite directors working. And it is a spectacular movie, and it is haunting. And I think it has one of the best, actually for you, Tom, especially, it has one of the best scores of an incredible score. Like one of the best, if not the best, this century. It is just, it's that good, I think.
Thanks, kid, because, I don't like music, so thanks, man.
Right. Right. You can enjoy it too, Andy, if you want.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate your permission.
You have my permission. But the movie is about an alien who is sort of an alien sort of robot who is driving around in Scotland kind of picking up men and seducing them so that they can be kind of utilized by the forces she's working for. I'll say that. And there is a shot in this. It's an over-the-shoulder shot of Jessica Chastain as she's riding in a car. And it feels almost something out of a documentary, more verite than the rest of the movie. And it feels out of place, but it really works for me because it really, really reminded me. And maybe I'm crazy. Maybe it's just me having this movie on the brain. But it really made me think of that movie. But and thematically, there's a lot of similarities there too. So that is the other moment that I quite enjoyed. Other than that, not so much.
So character relationships are important in this film. Do they work and resonate? Magneto, Raven, Beast, Xavier, they're all very connected, as are Jean and Scott and Xavier. Also, Storm is practically missing again. What's up with that? And I'm going to add to this question. Were either of you confused by the scrolls that weren't scrolls?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I was not confused by the Skrulls that weren't Skrulls because I brought to this movie my knowledge of X-Men comics, and there are no Skrulls in this storyline in the X-Men comics.
It just looked like them.
The Shi'ar Empire are
but in they were originally and, they were and Skrulls not, when they
and
first
they're
shot
not shapeshifters. What? Sorry, say that again, Skid.
When they originally shot the movie, they were Skrulls, and there were so many reshoots, and that was one of the changes they made.
I didn't realize that was one of the changes they made. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't think that was the case because I, through means I probably shouldn't talk about, know that Skrulls were not something Fox ever had the rights to. But that said, character relationships, aliens are aliens and they do different things. So that one didn't bother me. It stood out to you guys though? That's kind of interesting to me.
On this viewing, I was just like, oh, look at this. There's Skrulls in this movie. And then they weren't.
One thing I noticed on the viewing of this movie is how short Jessica Chastain is. I had no idea she was that short. I would have thought she was a fairly tall woman. But she
has the bearing of a much taller woman.
Yeah, she is remarkably short. Which doesn't matter at all. She is a phenomenal actress and largely wasted in this movie because her role is not one that emotes a whole lot. Although she's good.
I just thought you said largely wasted, like she had a big waist. I really thought you just said that.
I was so
confused. And then, okay, now her role was wasted. Her screen time was wasted.
Her skills as an actress were wasted.
That was the largest wasted performance I've seen by Jessica Chastain.
But I can't wait to try and figure out a way to say largely wasted to a woman I care about and then get summarily punched in the face.
They'd love that.
They would. I think they'd really appreciate the effort I go to insult them. But I will say that what was interesting to me about their relationships was I watched this movie after watching whatever 8 other X-Men movies prior to this and Wolverine movies. But so some things actually resonated with me, like to an extent, like when Beast goes to talk to Magneto, I'm going into that scene knowing Beast was in love with Mystique and that Magneto had a very close, seemingly very intimate relationship with Mystique. Both of those relationships happened in previous movies. So when they get together and they discuss Mystique, and then he realizes that Magneto realizes Jean Grey killed Mystique and says, if I find her for you, I'm going to kill her. And Beast is like, I'm okay with that. All of that kind of works for me because I brought 8 other movies with me. But
right.
This was the one X-Men movie I watched with one of my sons. So I watched this with my son Oliver, and he's not particularly an X-Men fan. And I found myself at multiple points in this movie going, like a scene would start, and I'd know kind of where it was headed, and I'd like lean over and be like, "Oh, okay, so you have to understand." Magneto had a relationship with Mystique. Beast had a relationship with Mystique. And I had to explain all of those things. So they're not actually, and I think this is a real problem for the movie, they're not actually in this movie. More so maybe than any other X-Men movie, you just have to know these things.
And
they work better. And so I don't feel like any of those are established. Even Xavier's relationship with Mystique, they do establish in that opening scene that she's like sort of like the team leader, like she's the elder X-Men statesman, which still feels wrong to me as an X-Men comics fan. But they don't really go into Xavier's relationship with Mystique in a way that I'm carrying. You know, like you see in First Class where they grow up together and they're brother and sister essentially, right? You don't feel that in this movie, you get a hint of it in the scene we talked about earlier in the breakfast room where Xavier says, this is the room where I met her. It doesn't look like that room at all, but this is the room where I met her for the first time. And he like sort of tells a little bit of the story of that meeting, but like you need that earlier. You need to have that with you earlier to resonate in some of the earlier scenes. And so, and then it would resonate more in that scene as well. And so the character relationships are really important, but they're also missing. And that's really weird.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
I will say that Oliver did like the movie. He got to the end of it and he was like, that was pretty fun. I'll also say Oliver, not an X-Men fan and hasn't really seen any of the other X-Men movies. So I am cautiously optimistic that he would watch X-Men 2 and be like, that was freaking amazing.
Yeah, like how is he going to react to a good X-Men movie? That's report back, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Again, like I don't hate this one, but I don't particularly like it. But like it also, and I know there was like, they like, I guess I don't have the details on this, and maybe one of you guys researched this a little bit better or has more insight into it, but they like reshot the whole ending because it was too similar, I think, to Captain Marvel. But
I know there were a ton of reshoots. That's one of the things that marked production.
And it was also planned to be two movies originally. It was supposed to be Dark Phoenix Part 1 and Part 2, which to our previous this conversation, but previously in this conversation, might have worked a lot better.
Yeah.
I don't know what you make a first movie of this about. Like, I feel like that first movie needs to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and conclude some story while Jean is getting more powerful and more angry or whatever.
Yeah.
And then that becomes
I don't know what that story would be. I don't know where, how you structure that. I don't know how you structure this, what we see as two films. I don't know.
I don't really know either. I do, I don't have anywhere else to go with that. And that might be because I'm still drinking.
But what drink number are you on?
Wait, which question should I answer first? I'm drinking straight bourbon in this case. I'm drinking sort of the family well drink. I'm drinking an old Forester, and I'm enjoying it greatly.
Oh, that's good bourbon.
Not neat.
Good drinking bourbon.
Excellent.
But yeah, that was one of the things, was like this movie, when it first came in, I guess it was like pretty well under budget. And so that maybe as a result, like they went nuts with the reshoots. Because they did a bunch of like focus groups and stuff. And I think that, I mean, that's rarely a good thing. That's rarely a good sign. Sometimes it does work out, but almost never. If we have that many like reshoots.
I can't wait till we talk about the Fantastic Four franchise and we talk about the reshoots on that, because it really helped that one.
No, but there was like, there's some recent movie that actually did have a bunch of reshoots and ended up being pretty good. And it is on the tip of my tongue and I can't remember it. American History X would be another example. Like that was one that was hacked to pieces and ended up actually being pretty good.
It's a really powerful movie.
Yeah, really good movie.
If you're not ready for something really like visceral and a gut punch, I don't recommend seeing. But if you want that, then I recommend seeing it because it's really good.
Yeah, and it's crazy because it was one of the most troubled productions that you could ever want to talk about. There's a documentary about it where they taught, like the director, like he tried to put an Alan Smithy, tried to pull his name off it and make it an Alan Smithy film. And this is the movie that actually stopped the practice of when a union member wanted to remove their name from a project they weren't happy with, they would replace their name with the name Alan Smithy. And so, but it was such a big deal in the trades because of like Edward Norton, like kind of blew it up and everything. Everyone was talking about Alan Smithy. It became so widely known by the public that they just stopped doing it. But that was a thing that they did. So yeah, it was a disaster of a movie. Tons of reshoots, tons of rewrites, and yet it ended up being like a really, really very good movie. So
we talked about the Alan Smithy thing when talking about Hellraiser, and I'm pretty sure Hellraiser 4, Bloodline, was the last movie credited with Alan Smithy.
Oh, is that? That's okay. That's probably right.
I was like 96.
But maybe Hellraiser 4 wasn't the movie that like blew that up because the credit exists. And maybe it was American History X. Maybe I had that wrong when we talked about
American History X is like 2000, right?
Or yeah, American History X made it like impossible for Alan Smithy to work anymore because people knew what Alan Smithy was. The whole thing about
that's
Alan
why,
Smithy
it
was like, you didn't
Alan
know,
Smithy.
Like, is that a dude? I guess.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, that's it for this episode of Franchise Fan Guys. If you're a Patreon subscriber, stick around where we're going to ask the question, is Dark Phoenix bad for the X-Men franchise?
Please write a review and give a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts. Intro music by Tom Breifogel and John Harvey. To connect, visit FranchiseFanGuys.com, at FranchiseFanGuys on Instagram, and at GuysFranchise on Twitter. Franchise Fan Guys.